watches. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And this week
you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP, Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP, Salida, WGDR, Plainfield, Free Radio Asheville, WZKW, Kingsville, or WRFN, Nashville. The words freedom and democracy are often heard as part of the official dialogue to describe what our society is and has and what others lack. The meanings of these words are generally undefined, and their application to what actually happens in this society is considered too outre for mainstream political discourse. The unmentioned elephant in the parlor is that our putative American freedoms accrue to individuals in proportion to their position in an economic hierarchy that dooms most to a life with very little freedom indeed. If freedom means the ability to amply meet one's physical survival needs with dignity, so that one may spend one's time and effort in a meaningful and emotionally satisfying way. Is our economic system based on employment compatible with a free society or with self-government? That's what we'll look at on this week's Unwelcome Guests. I'm your host, Lynn Gary. We'll begin as C.S. Sung of KPFA's Against the Grain speaks with two organizers who are drawing the connection between the politics of class globally and the living wage movement in America.
The system called capitalism does certain things to certain people. A political economic arrangement called neoliberalism has wide-ranging consequences both here and abroad. This age of imperialism, spearheaded by the United States, has a method and a madness and a set of concrete effects on people and communities around the globe. How do we understand it all? Can we be effective activists and informed citizens without that understanding? A group of organizers called Power, and specifically its Amandla Project, has produced a unique book entitled Towards Land, Work, and Power, which is nothing less than an analysis of how power operates and what forces are driving change in society. Joining me in studio are two of the four co-authors of the book and two members of Power, Jaron Brown and Steve Williams. Welcome to you both.
Thanks for having us.
Steve, let me begin with you and ask you about how this book originated and how did you folks come to decide to write it?
Well, first, a little bit of background about Power. Power is an organization of low-wage workers and low-income tenants in San Francisco. We've been organizing for the past 8 years. We actually began organizing welfare recipients, folks who were forced to do public sector work in exchange for their welfare benefits. And in the context of that organizing drive, we were constantly trying to push the city to create living wage jobs for unemployed and underemployed workers in San Francisco. But increasingly, we were finding that we were having difficulty realizing what kind of jobs we wanted the city to create. We recognized that the majority of job creation in San Francisco, particularly for working class people of color, were in the low wage service sector. And we didn't want to call for the creation of more Walmart jobs or more Dunkin' Donuts jobs. But we really wanted jobs that low income people were going to be able to satisfactorily live in San Francisco to raise their families. And we didn't know what kind of jobs that meant to create. Mm-hmm. We basically felt like we didn't understand broadly the political economy of San Francisco. And we knew that we wanted to make broad sweeping changes to the reality of low-income people in the city. But we felt like then in order to make that change, we were ultimately going to have a deeper understanding of the existing political economy and also hopefully develop some alternatives to figure out how it is that we can begin to satisfactorily move people to a point where they actually have land, work, and the power to be able to create their own destiny.
And there are a number of names you assign to this system, what surrounds us, what operates on us every day. Capitalism is one. Imperialism, which you call an advanced form of capitalism, is another. And neoliberalism is yet another. And maybe, Jaron, we could start with capitalism. And you folks associate capitalism with two things in this book, socialized production and private appropriation. Can you give me a sense of what those two things mean?
I think one thing is that in writing this book, we really felt like we needed to go back to a deep understanding of political economy and realizing that we weren't the first ones to ask these questions. So I think that this assessment of capitalism is really drawing on the tradition of Marxism, drawing on the tradition of different political economists who attempted to understand the polarization of wealth that happens as capitalism develops out of feudalism. So when we looked at the development of capitalism, part of the first thing is understanding class. And we look at, within feudalism, you had a system where you had a class division begin under patriarchy. So you had basically male landowners who were considered owners of not only their land and not only all the people who worked their land, but also the wife and their children. So you had the system of a class division. And as capitalism sort of grew out of that system, you basically have a situation where factories began to develop, where that wealth that those male landowners were able to accumulate allowed them to buy up what's considered the means of production. So land, tools for manufacturing things. And so then you have a system where you have people who work. Everybody has to work under capitalism in order to survive. You have to sell your labor, but you don't have control over what it is that you produce. It's considered to be the property of the owner of that factory. And so over time that continues to develop where you have a very small number of people who are benefiting from the labor of the majority of the people in the society. And that begins to create this polarization through capitalism where a small number of people are generating a tremendous amount of wealth.
And this small minority of people making a benefit off the rest of the people, the workers, is the capitalist class. Mm-hmm. And I wonder, you know, there's a lot of talk, of course, about profits and profits driving all kinds of things in today's society. Steve Williams, basically, how does a capitalist go about making a profit? How does that work?
So that process happens by the exploitation of the worker by the capitalist. And so there's an example that we use in the book of a chair-making factory where one worker in the book, we use the example of Maria, is forced because she doesn't own the means of production to be able to provide for her basic daily sustenance. She's forced to go in and sell her labor to the capitalist who does own the means of production.
The factory, the machinery, what you were saying.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And so in this case, Maria is forced to then make chairs. And the example in the book is that she's making chairs. Each hour she's able to make two chairs that ultimately will sell for $12 a piece. During that 1 hour, the capitalist is paying her a wage of $8 an hour. But the fact of the matter is that she's actually creating then $24 worth of value in exchange for the $8 that she receives as wages. So there's a $16 difference that then is going directly into the pocket of the capitalist. Now, that exploitation, as Marx talks about it, happens every hour of the day for every worker who is working for a capitalist. And so the profit literally comes from the excess value that is created by the workers that is then ultimately appropriated by the capitalist class.
That's the voice of Steve Williams. He and Jaron Brown are two of the authors, along with Marissa Franco and Jason Negron Gonzalez, of Towards Land, Work, and Power. And the subtitle is Charting a Path of Resistance to U.S.-Led Imperialism. It's put out by the good folks at Power, which is a San Francisco-based multiracial membership organization that works to end poverty and oppression and to help people fight for greater control over conditions in their workplaces and in their communities. Jaron, there is a certain dynamic, it's a dynamic process because there's something capitalists are driven to do by the system, by capitalism, with the means of production to somehow always change it, to improve it. Can you talk about that?
Yes. Part of the dynamic of capitalism is that it's always in a process of change. And part of that is that there's a tendency to need to produce things faster and cheaper in order to deal with competition within the system. So you have different capitalists that are all, let's say, having these chair factories that we used in the earlier example. And so as more and more chairs are being produced, there's a need to try to undersell your competitor. And so they're constantly trying to revolutionize the means of production so they can come up with a way to do it faster and cheaper, faster and cheaper. And there's a tendency that happens over time where the rate of profit declines over time. And so there's a constant pressure on capitalists to continually find ways to extract more and more profit. And as that's talked about is that capitalists basically need to grow or to die. Basically, the system, you can't stagnate. You can't just have your chair factory and make your same chair at the same price and not be gobbled up by your competitors at a certain point. And so it's a really accelerating system that runs into problems because you have a finite number of places you can grow to, new markets you can find, new places you can sell your chairs, and there's a limited number of natural resources within the world that we're dealing with. And I think those are some of the dynamics that begin to push capitalism into the current period, as you talked about, that we're dealing with now, of imperialism. Once capitalism sort of has continued to expand to the point where it covers the globe.
Well, Steve, lay that out for us, because as I mentioned before, you characterize the political economy of today's world as imperialism, which is an advanced form of capitalism. So once the means of production are kind of constantly revolutionized, once new markets are constantly sought out because, I guess, you know, you have to have somebody to buy these products that you're making for a profit, something maybe needs to change or to be adjusted. Why is imperialism different from then, say, a less advanced stage of capitalism?
Well, I think it is really this whole process that Jaron was talking about of competition. And so oftentimes we hear that capitalism is a wonderful system of political economy because of the competition, and it drives the system to be able to produce newer and better products that other systems aren't able to produce. I think that it is in that process of the quest for profit, ultimately, though, that the system is producing new stuff. It's not producing it to satisfy human needs, but it is producing for the sake of trying to achieve more profit. In the process of capitalist production, over time, the less successful capitalists are ultimately bought out by more successful capitalists. And so then you have the emergence of large capitalist entities, which we talk about as monopolies, a term that comes out of the Marxist tradition, where you have fewer and fewer corporations that actually control larger and larger sections of the economy. In that process, those monopolies begin to integrate the entire globe into a fully integrated economy, so that no longer do you just have an English version of capitalism, a German version of capitalism, a Bolivian version of capitalism, but you have a truly globally integrated system of political economy that also has a direct relationship then to nation states. So as the system continues to grow and grow, it also becomes more vulnerable because there's crisis that's built into the genetic fiber of capitalism. And as the system grows larger and larger, as the system becomes more and more thoroughly integrated into one unified system, it also becomes more susceptible to crisis.
And I want to get to the crises inherent perhaps in the capitalist system. But first of all, let me stick with you, Steve. This idea that under capitalism, we always hear about the oppression of the working class, right? The oppression of the proletariat in Marxist terms. Who or what is oppressed under imperialism, under this bigger system?
Well, under imperialism, one of the changes that takes place is that where in capitalism, the sort of what we talk about is the basic unit of exploitation is between the worker and the boss. What happens under the system of imperialism is that basic unit transforms in a global context, so that the basic unit of exploitation under imperialism is really between the first world, the capitalist class of the first world, and the working class of the global south or the third world. And so really what we see in an anti-imperialist struggle is really a global struggle between the global south and the global north.
That is Steve Williams, and he and Jaron Brown are two of the authors of this book, Towards Land, Work, and Power, just out. Actually, it's coming out very shortly from Power, which is the people organized to win employment rights based in San Francisco. Jaron Brown, Steve, you know, began talking about sort of this issue of capitalism's crises, imperialism's crises. And a lot of people think, well, capitalism just rules the world. You can't be defeated. It's monolithic. It has no vulnerabilities. What's your sense of what kind of crises capitalism and imperialism is vulnerable to?
Well, and we looked at it. There are two core crises that exist under capitalism and continue under imperialism that are really some of the fundamental crises driving the changes that we see taking place now. And one of those crises is a tendency toward overproduction. So basically, if you're constantly trying to make things faster and better and more and easier, you end up at a point where everybody's already bought their chairs. You know, they don't need any more chairs. They don't really want any more chairs. And so you have a glut of production. And we see that a lot now, where you have excess capital and there's nothing productive that they can invest in. You know, we've all got, you know, those who are capable of buying and consuming things are beyond what they're capable of consuming. And so the way that the system tries to deal with it is by, one, constantly convincing people to buy more and trying to figure out more reasons why people need to continue to consume, but also producing things that don't last as long, you know, and basically a system where you end up where there is a search for new markets and a search for new ways to kind of dump excess things on people. But there's a point at which the system doesn't know what to do with the excess production. And the second tendency toward crisis that exists within capitalism is, again, this tendency for the rate of profit to decline. And so that over time, there's just less and less profit that capitalists are able to extract from the products that they've created. And in part, that's tied to this process of introducing more and more technology, because over time, if one of the central ways that capitalists are able to extract profit is by paying Maria less money for the actual labor she's putting into her product, as the capitalist is employing less and less workers through technology, there's actually less ability to produce that amount of profit. And that's a Marxist concept that's called the labor theory of value. But those two systems that exist under capitalism create a kind of urgency on the part of the capitalist to try to figure out a new way to make money, and a tendency toward a basic kind of economic stagnation that repeats in cycles over the development of the system.
And that urgency, Jaron, that urgency was manifestly evident in the 1970s, because you have a historical analysis in this book as well, and there was about a quarter century after World War II in which everything seemed to go well for the capitalists. And then something happened in the 70s which highlighted the crises, the vulnerabilities of, as you said, overproduction and the tendency of the rate of profit to fall. What happened? What did the capitalists do in the early and mid-70s to address what it saw as a possible, I don't know what you call a failure of the capitalist system, but certainly a weakening of the capitalist system as they saw it?
Well, there were two key things that happened in the 1970s that sort of marked an exposure of the vulnerabilities of the system. And those two things were, one, in the 1970s, 1971, the U.S. was forced to de-link the dollar from the gold standard. Basically, the U.S. had produced so many dollars in order to simultaneously attempt to keep a war going against communism and keep a war going in Vietnam while trying to maintain a high standard of living at home. And they they basically couldn't continue to maintain that based on the amount of gold that the country had. So they had to de-link the dollar from the gold standard. And the second thing was in 1973 when the OPEC nations quadrupled the price of oil in retaliation to the U.S. and Europe's support for the October war in Israel. And so when those things happened, the U.S. was heavily dependent on foreign oil, consumed 33% of the world's oil at that time. And it created a level of crisis, basically, within the country that already was there, but it made it visible to the world that there was an instability within the U.S. leadership of imperialism. And so that crafted this new set of strategies that we've seen emerge since the 1970s. And we saw that characterized in three core strategies. And one is neoliberalism, which we can talk more about. And you mentioned earlier, it is a whole set of policies that's geared toward publicly subsidizing corporations in order to mask their actual economic stagnation that they're undergoing. The second was the fabrication of what we refer to as a casino economy. So basically a large, heavily investment-oriented economy versus a production-oriented economy.
A lot of speculation, for
exactly.
example.
Mm-hmm. And lastly is a period of militarism and aggressive military activity globally.
Steve, let me ask you about neoliberalism. A lot of people get confused by this term because they think, well, I'm liberal, I'm kind of on the left, and therefore what's wrong with neoliberalism? But neoliberalism seems to be very powerful. It's been around for several decades. What are its principal tenets?
So the whole policy, the whole sort of ideology of neoliberalism was developed in the early 1970s out of the University of Chicago. And economists there were really grappling with this question that imperialism in some respects, and particularly the United States in its leadership role under the imperialist system, had been so successful at integrating the world into one globalized system that there were few places where they could actually place their investment and actually get a profitable return. And so there was a need for the imperialist class to almost fabricate profits, to be able to sort of take profits from places that they wouldn't have otherwise existed. And so some of the main features of neoliberalism are, one, sort of the privatization, which there are clearly numerous fights taking place both inside this country and all around the globe, where particularly states, nation states, are almost turning over once publicly held resources like water, electricity, what have you, turning them over to corporations, where corporations are literally able to sort of smooth over their loss of profits in other areas and then being able to sort of make up for them in those particular places. Another aspect of neoliberalism is deregulation, making it easier for corporations to go about the process of accumulating profit in all of their endeavors, making environmental regulations less strong, weakening worker rights protections. And then another aspect of neoliberalism has been the increased feminization then of poverty, putting women, both moving women globally into the workforce in super exploited positions, but then also making women bear the responsibility of the elimination of the social wage, of social benefits programs like welfare, like publicly subsidized health programs that used to facilitate the process of nurturing the family and communities, responsibilities that are oftentimes gendered in a way that women ultimately wind up carrying those responsibilities.
What I think you've already begun to answer this, but Jaron, what is the relative importance of nation states on the one hand and corporations on the other? Both, especially, of course, the U.S. nation tends to be vilified by the left, right? And so, what is more dangerous, and what ought activists to focus more on, perhaps?
Well, I think that there's clearly a need to focus on both of those aspects of what's driving the system right now. But one thing that we found is that there's a central role, particularly under neoliberalism, that's being played by the state. And we look at a particular importance and responsibility that we have within the context of the U.S. to be aggressively taking on the activities that this government is doing. Because right now we see that the U.S. state is largely responsible for forcing the policies of neoliberalism and of structural adjustment on the global south, on the, you know, a process of attempting to recolonize Africa, Asia, and Latin America through its different apparatuses of the IMF and the World Bank. And that is really largely being driven by the U.S. government. And so we see that there's a central responsibility to be aggressively attacking those policies from within the empire, because they're also not in the interest of working class people within the U.S. But then when you look at what's going on in terms of the level of colonization and an effort to control natural resources in the Middle East and around the world, and when we look at the struggles and the openings and the efforts at sovereignty, whether in Haiti or in Venezuela, we can see the in critical role that the U.S. is playing right now in attempting to suppress the real incredible liberatory movements around the world. And so we see that in our position within the United States, our central task right now is to stop this government. Because it is not only responsible for the polarization of wealth globally, but it's directly responsible for the conditions of African American, Latin American, and Asian Pacific Islander, Native American people who we see as a third world within the United States that has a tremendous amount of common struggle with the global south. And that's what we see as our critical united front that we need to begin to build.
We're talking about a new book. It's entitled Towards Land, Work, and Power. The four co-authors of it are part of the Amandla Project of Power, which is people organized to win employment rights. Power is a San Francisco-based multiracial membership organization of people like welfare recipients, domestics, childcare workers, restaurant workers, unemployed workers, other no and low-wage workers. And what these four people have done, Jaron Brown and Steve Williams in studio, Marissa Franco and Jason Negron Gonzalez, who couldn't join us today, what this book is about is helping them and helping us understand what the system is doing to us, the better to organize people against it. And it's a great book. I congratulate you, all four of you, on it and Power in general. Steve, there's also a discussion in this book about imperialist powers creating what's called a labor aristocracy. What is that?
Yeah, so this is an idea that we really drew from the writings of Lenin in his work, Imperialism, the Highest Stage of Capitalism. And in that book, he talks about the idea that under imperialism, the ruling class is able to extract such a high degree of profit by exploiting particularly the global south that they're able to throw crumbs at the working class within first world nations to actually buy off their allegiance. So that the working class would actually support the ruling class of the first world nations, even though it might be against the interest of the working class globally. And I think for us, it was a really important concept to then understand how it is that we see dynamics taking place in politics in the United States, why it is that the AFL-CIO has had such a long history of supporting U.S. intervention and military action around the globe, why it is that working class people, even outside of trade unions, have been reluctant to support third world national liberation movements around the globe. And so I think for us, this whole concept of a global aristocracy really began to highlight the particular role and responsibility of working class people, and particularly working class African-American, Latino, and Asian Pacific Islander folks, to actually begin affiliating themselves not with the ruling class of the United States, but instead with the working class of the global south. And that is where our true class interests lie. And so as we begin sort of constructing organizing campaigns in our communities here in San Francisco, throughout the Bay Area, it's critical that we begin developing the consciousness of working class people of color, that we actually have a deep, strong connection with the people of the global south.
And maybe this is a good segue into kind of what to do and what would be required of a strong construction of a strong anti-imperialist movement in the U.S. And Jaron, this book admits, it concedes that the anti-imperialist movement in the U.S. is weak and fragmented. So what kinds of things need to be done to revitalize it?
Well, when we looked at the most urgent tasks of this period, we saw three core activities that we think are the priority. There's a lot that needs to be done to rebuild the U.S. left, and I think that we recognize that we're coming out of a tremendous period of repression where a lot of the movements that we can't come up out of and that we borrow from in writing this book were so heavily attacked through COINTELPRO and through the periods of really trying to roll back the gains of the civil rights movement and the national liberation movements. But we look at now, our task is, first and foremost, we need to build organization rooted in the working class and conscious organizations. So we look at that as what we call independent organizations, meaning independent of the AFL-CIO, independent of the Democratic Party, in the sense that they're able to organize similar to what we were just talking about in a way that aligns with a consciousness toward global equity and toward movement building. The second core task that we see in this period is the need to try to de-link this state corporate alliance that's been built and to really target the state within this country to demand basic human rights. I mean, really what we're talking about is the strength that comes from working class people actually demanding a right to fair and affordable housing, demanding a right to quality education, accessible health care. And we're seeing that right now the system can't actually accommodate those demands. When you look at a community like Bayview Hunters Point that has 50% unemployment, the demand for full employment with living wage jobs is something that would present a tremendous challenge, but also an incredible stronghold for our communities. And the third thing that we look at is the need to combat racist patriotism and really begin to develop, as we've been talking about, a conscious solidarity with the third world.
Steve, I want to follow up on something you said, which is something about people of color communities in this country, and you referred to it, I think, as oppressed nationality communities in the U.S. What specific role should they play in an emerging anti-imperialist movement, and how important is it for them to come to the forefront, so to speak?
I think one of the main themes that we try to draw out of the book is that as we look at understanding how change is going to take place, that we have to understand two particular forces. First, we have to understand what are the actual conditions that we're facing in the world. And then we also have to understand what are the forces that are affected by those conditions who will actually have the capacity to make change. And I think from our analysis of imperialism, our sense is that it is particularly working class, African American, Latino, Asian Pacific Islander folks who are inside the United States who are most directly impacted by imperialism inside this country. And given that, it's important that those folks actually wind up playing a leadership role in any movement to try to end exploitation and oppression. But because of the fragmentation of each of those communities and because of our relative minority status within each of those individual communities, it's critical, as Jaron was pointing out earlier, to build a broad united front amongst African-American, Latino, Asian Pacific Islander, Middle Eastern, Native American folks who are actually consciously opposed to U.S. imperialism and who are willing to sort of stand up for the self-determination of their communities and our homelands.
Let me ask either of you about, I think, another very important point in this book, and that is sort of a caution against being United States-centric in the way that it promotes or thinks it's promoting the values of oppressed communities. What's the potential pitfall here?
I think that part of the potential pitfall is that we recognize that we're living within an empire. So again, it's sort of what we've talked about earlier, that if we really just focus on winning concessions within the context of the United States, that those concessions are so often built on the super exploitation of the third world. So that if one example we were talking about earlier is, you know, we waged a campaign that we feel like was a really incredible campaign to raise the minimum wage in San Francisco, and it affected 50,000 workers and brought $1.8 million back into the hands of working class people in the United States, in San Francisco. And yet, at the same time, that if we're constantly working only to try to raise wages here and try to build conditions here, the reality is that those wage levels are being based on the corporation's ability to find that wealth somewhere else. And so we're looking at ways constantly to uphold the demands that are happening, because many times the corporations that we're working for are simultaneously the same corporations that are exploiting countries in the third world. And so as we're building, for example, right now we're organizing domestic workers in San Francisco, and as we're building that campaign that's largely migrant Latina immigrant workers in San Francisco, we're trying to look at what are the demands that are being upheld by domestic workers and migrant workers throughout Asia who are doing the same work, who are in those same conditions, and how can we begin to really link our solidarity together.
Jaron Brown and Steve Williams, co-authors with Marissa Franco and Jason Negron Gonzalez, and they are part, by the way, of the Amandla Project of the group Power. The book is Towards Land, Work, and Power, Charting a Path of Resistance to U.S.-Led Imperialism. Thank you both very much for writing the book, for co-writing the book, and for coming in to talk about it.
The interviewer was C.S. Sung of Against the Grain. Check out againstthegrain.org to hear more of the fabulous work of C.S. Sung and his producer, Sasha Lilly. For more information on Power, People Organized to Win Employment Rights, visit www.fairwork.org. Over the past decade, a new phrase has become part of the vocabulary, going postal, to describe individuals who crack and go on killing sprees at their workplaces and schools. Are these bizarre individual aberrants, or are they canaries in the coal mine, revealing something fundamental and unacknowledged about our society? Mark Ames, who is an American, is the editor of The Exile, a Moscow-based alternative newspaper. He is the author of a new book, Going Postal: Rage, Murder, and Rebellion, From Reagan's Workplaces to Clinton's Columbine and Beyond. Next, I'm going to read you an extended excerpt from the book, which Ames posted on his website, exile.ru. Ames begins, "If Ward Cleaver were alive today, he'd rarely be home to see his wife and children. And when home, he'd be an impossible crank, always getting called on the cell phone or buzzed on the BlackBerry. The stress from seeing his health insurance slashed would only be overshadowed by the fear caused by another round of white-collar downsizing and vicious memos from the senior executives implying that more fat was yet to be cut from the company payrolls. Mr. Cleaver would work weekends and forego vacations and likely vote Republican, forced to choose between the hypertension medicine and the blood thinner pills since he can't afford both, not under the new corporate HMO plan. His anger and stress would push him into cursing Canada for being a hotbed of anti-American liberalism, while at the same time he'd agonize over whether or not to order his medicines from their cheap online pharmacies. He'd have no time for imparting little moral lessons. 'Not now, leave me alone,' he'd grumble, washing down the last of his Comedins with a low-carb, non-alcoholic beer while watching the O'Reilly Factor through clenched teeth. His wife, June, would be stuck at a 3-day merchandising conference at a Holiday Inn in Tempe, if they weren't divorced by now, while the Beaver would be standing in front of his bedroom dresser mirror in his long black trench coat, clutching his homemade pipe bombs and plotting revenge on Eddie Haskell and all the other kids who called him gay and bitch and make his life a living hell." A nondescript Warren of an office. The first reports of the Rage Massacre at the Connecticut State Lottery gave the impression that the shooter, 35-year-old accountant Matthew Beck, was a barking lunatic. He had been treated for mental illness and suicidal tendencies, and now he had finally gone over the edge, slaughtering his co-workers with all the deranged purpose of a Freddy Krueger. He played paintball, they noted. At his father's house, where Beck lived his last 6 months, a sign read, "Trespassers will be shot. Survivors will be shot again." But the most chilling image was that of Beck standing over his last victim in the office parking lot with a gun aimed at the man's head. The victim pleaded for his life, and the frightened co-workers who were hiding in the nearby woods yelled for Beck to spare him. But Beck just smiled and shot the man in cold blood, before turning the gun on himself. Yet what emerged later from more comprehensive accounts was far more ambiguous than first allowed. Matthew Beck worked at the Connecticut State Lottery as an accountant for 8 years. He was considered a hard-working and loyal employee. But near the end, he grew angry and disgruntled because he was not getting the promotions he felt he deserved. In our post-Reagan culture, most Americans would instinctively side with Beck's supervisors, operating on the assumption that corporations generally operate like efficient meritocracies rather than crude popularity contests. Yet, in each American's own private experience, we know how profound a role the supposed non-occupational factors, office politics, personal relations, connections, petty malice, attendance at the company barbecue, hygiene, fashion, one's ability to smile and make it look sincere, a sense of humor or what passes for a sense of humor in the office world, as well as sheer luck and circumstance play in an employee's ability to advance up the company ladder. Beck was described by his coworkers as a diligent and quiet employee, a subtle way to describe an employee who doesn't play for the company's softball team or peck his fellow workers with wacky jokes and anecdotes. Beck had hoped to get promoted at last to associate accountant, which would have made him a supervisor and increased his pay. But he was skipped over despite his work and seniority. To make matters worse, less than 6 months before his murder rampage, he was assigned to do data processing on top of his stagnating accounting duties. This was adding insult to injury, especially as they underpaid him for the new work by roughly $2 per hour, according to a grievance that he filed and subsequently won. Was he passed over for the promotion because of poor performance? One supervisor whom he'd spared, Karen Kalandike, admitted that when it came to computers, quote, he was so much beyond the rest of us that you tried to use his talents. His problems then? He couldn't communicate. He couldn't tell us what he knew, Kalandike said. In other words, he didn't join the depressing soup Nazi citation tournaments with other employees over by the water cooler. In August 1997, Beck filed a grievance against the state to complain about his unfair treatment. Fellow employees say that around this time, Beck changed both physically and emotionally. He went from being a quiet, diligent worker to a broken and bitter man. He was always angry about not being promoted, one supervisor said. He became visibly withdrawn into himself around the time that he filed his grievance, said John Krinjak, a lottery sales rep. He took on a severe look, an angry look. He looked like he had lost weight and gotten pale. For a while there, I thought he was really pale. There's no indication that this obvious physical deterioration elicited any sympathy or support from Beck's supervisors or co-workers. Rather, what they conveyed to reporters is something like revulsion. Clearly, he didn't fit into the frat house, and they did their best to push him out. He looked a little evil in a way, said another accountant, David Perlow. He talked a little sinister-like. He struck me as odd, not the kind of person that I wanted to get close to. Close quote. Was he always this way? Was he born weird and evil? Or did his experience at the Connecticut Lottery somehow deform his personality? Here's how a shocked childhood friend, Herbert Vars, described Beck. He was the all-American guy. He was Mr. Clean Cut. Another childhood friend said that going back to elementary school, he'd never even seen Beck argue with someone. I would never have expected it from him, he said, noting that they had continued to hang out and even hike together until Beck's downward spiral. Yet after 8 years as an accountant with the state lottery, he was odd. Not the type I wanted to get close to. His missed promotion had less to do with his work performance and more to do with the conditioned behavior his supervisors wanted of their underlings. Beck did not have the cheerful attitude that masters prefer. 2 months after filing the grievance, Beck took a medical leave, suffering from the effects of stress. He was falling apart. It must have been painful for Beck not only to work for and take orders from people who refused to promote him, but worse, for people who ordered him to work more for no extra pay, people who must have been quietly and subtly getting their revenge on him for filing the grievance. Beck's relationship with his girlfriend suffered. He moved back home with his parents, underwent treatment at a psychiatric hospital, and started to take psychiatric medicines. He even tried committing suicide. For someone clearly intelligent, industrious, and quiet like Beck to get rejected and mistreated by his workplace after 8 years of hard, quiet, diligent work, which even after his shooting spree was described as, quote, so much beyond the rest of us you tried to use his talents, was a cruel and disrespectful harassment. It must have struck him as an injustice of cosmic proportions. When he was finally denied his promotion, he essentially saw it as the end of his life. While on leave, Beck turned whistleblower. He went to the local newspapers exposing corruption in the Connecticut lottery. In November 1997, lottery officials admitted that they had inflated their figures for years by rounding up numbers to the nearest half million. They needed to increase revenues by $30 million, and they're under a lot of pressure to let other things take a back seat, Beck told the New London Day newspaper. He also exposed to the Hartford Courant how some store clerks were cheating the system by phishing for instant winning tickets. The clerks would punch code numbers into lottery computers until they came up with a winning combination, and then they'd take the cash. Lottery officials at the time of the shooting spree refused to comment on this allegation. Beck also tried to interest reporters in his own employment grievance against the lottery, but they didn't bite. According to an Associated Press story, here is why. The Courant described him as frothing at the mouth and said his eyes were wild, while the Day described him as scruffy in appearance. There's quite a difference between appearing scruffy and frothing at the mouth. Perhaps what they simply meant was that Beck didn't smile much. Try to understand Beck's profound sense of dislocation. Here, he worked for the state lottery, which by definition is already a sleazy enterprise, a government-run scam that preys like all gambling dens on the desperate dreams of predominantly lower-class fools. And even in this officially sanctioned scam, the state was scamming its own scam to make the scam look like it was working. Yet the same corrupt supervisors who were fixing the scam were at the same time passing judgment on Beck's life, condemning him to stagnation, not for being a bad worker, but for not being one of the boys. And Beck was the crazy one? He was expected to shut up and take it? I saw no prospect that my condition would ever be changed, yet I used to plan in my mind from day to day, from night to night, how I might be free. That quote from the narration of Lunsford Lane, a slave memoir, published in 1842. Otho Brown, the lottery president, told the media that the lottery's practice of inflating figures had been stopped. Brown was the man Beck later shot in the parking lot. In January 1998, Beck won the first part of his grievance against the lottery, so he wasn't imagining his injustice. But the damage had already been done. He was crushed. While still awaiting the grievance board's ruling on his back pay, Beck decided to return to work. His colleagues were openly hostile upon seeing him return. They had him marked as a loser. As one employee who asked to remain anonymous told the New York Times, he knew he wasn't going to go anywhere. Management distrusted him. In February 1998, just a week after returning to work at the lottery, one of Beck's supervisors gave him the task of tracking lottery employees who were given state vehicles as a fringe benefit. It must have been like salt in the wounds. Why don't you monitor other privileged employees who get the perks we've denied you? The office massacre took place on March 6th. Like the word stress,
office is far too simple a word to describe both the oppressive spirit of the place and also the typical degrading interior. It cannot describe how, by sheer dehumanizing design, it flattens you with that horrible fluorescent light, those white walls, beige cubicle partitions, the trim industrial carpeting, the disinfected scented restroom stalls, and the buzzing vending machines. One local reporter described the state lottery office as a nondescript warren of offices, a maze-like collection of cubicles and small offices connected by narrow hallways to still more offices in the one-story concrete block building. The New York Times reporter on the scene offered this picture, quote, "It is an ordinary building, beige, with a warehouse in the back. But to many people, the headquarters of the Connecticut Lottery is a place of fantasy where the big winners go to pose with a big cardboard check. They follow the bright yellow prize claim center sign into a special reception area and collect jackpots from 600 to hundreds of thousands of dollars. There is another entrance, one used by the secretaries, accountants, data processors, and other employees that keep the lottery humming. They must punch in a security code to enter the rabbit's warren of cubicles and partitions. An outsider could easily get turned around in this maze, but Matthew Beck, an accountant who had worked at the lottery for more than 8 years, he knew where he was going, and on Friday morning, he knew what he wanted to do." Close quote. In other words, an office just like any other. Did the journalists who wrote these descriptions understand that they were describing part of the murder spree's cause? And I'm reading an excerpt from Going Postal by Mark Ames. Continuing, "It was casual Friday at this nondescript warren of offices, a day which most well-conditioned American workers greet cheerfully. But in its own subtle way, the concept of casual day is just another demeaning reminder of how much power the company has over you, even commanding how you look and dress, when you need to stiffen up and when you can relax. Even slaves had their version of casual Friday. As Robert Anderson noted in From Slavery to Affluence, the slave on a plantation could get together almost any time they felt like it, for little social affairs, so long as it didn't interfere with the work on the plantation. Matthew Beck wore jeans and a brown leather jacket for casual day. At the start of the workday, Beck was seen speaking to his former data processing supervisor, Michael Logan. Logan was the first to deny Beck's grievance over his non-promotion, before the complaint was taken to a higher authority. And Logan was the IT manager who oversaw Beck's humiliating and illegal added workload for no extra pay the year before, when he was moved to data processing work. A coworker said Beck looked real ticked off while talking to Logan. Linda Milnarczyk, the chief financial officer and Beck's senior supervisor in the accounting wing, another key oppressor from his experience, walked past and told Beck to take off his coat. It was 30 minutes into the workday, and keeping your leather coat on was not in the spirit of casual day. But Beck wasn't in a casual day mood, so he answered her curtly, no. Logan finished talking with Beck and walked back into his office. Beck sat at his cubicle for a few minutes, staring off into space. At 8:45 a.m., he stood up and walked into Logan's office. After a brief confrontation, Beck pulled out a military-style knife and plunged it into Logan's stomach and chest, killing him. He then backtracked toward the front of the building and barged into a meeting room. Again, the privileged class meeting room acts as a focal point for the raging insurgent. The meeting was led by Milnarczyk and attended by four other employees in the accounting department. Beck keyed into his objective, the CFO herself. He pulled out a Glock 9mm semi-automatic handgun from his coat, pointed it at Milnarczyk and said, "Bye-bye." He shot Milnarczyk 3 times, killing her. Just a few days before, she'd met with Beck to explain to him his new duties now that he had returned to work. It's not hard to imagine how uncomfortable that meeting must have been for the humiliated, aggrieved Beck. Nor is it difficult to imagine the subtle way that a supervisor who dislikes her employee can transmit contempt. Milnarczyk had previously served as mayor of nearby New Britain, a city of 70,000 with a large ethnic Polish population. She was the first Republican to be elected mayor of New Britain in 20 years, and she was tossed out after just one term. Her single term was marked by controversy over the fact that she had privatized the city cemetery and named her fiancé the corporation council. She also forced the city union to make concessions to lower expenses and make New Britain more, quote, business-friendly. While she may have been for the free market and fair competition, when it came to her own fortunes, Milnarczyk practiced familiar old Europe rules of the back-scratching nepotism sort. She was the first mayor in Connecticut to endorse Republican John Rowland for governor, so when she lost re-election and he won, the victorious Rowland duly appointed her CFO of the state lottery. As CFO, she was responsible for the lottery's numbers, which were later admitted to have been cooked, though she never took a fall for the lottery accounting scandal. Beck got destroyed by her and other supervisors for much less. Meanwhile, her patron, Governor Rowland, was forced to resign as governor in the summer of 2004 in the wake of a federal corruption probe and numerous ethics violations that were building toward an impeachment. He was the first Connecticut governor ever to have been fined for ethics violations prior to his resignation. Beck shot Milnarczyk dead, but rather than shooting the others in the meeting room, employees whom Beck knew well, he just lowered the gun and walked away, said mid-level supervisor Callan Dyke, the same one who had complimented Beck's intelligence in the New York Times. I made eye contact, and his eyes were dead. Another colleague in the room noted that Beck gave him a grin or smirk before walking out. In the hallway, there was pandemonium as workers screamed and fled through the maze of cubicles toward the warehouse. Milnarczyk's office was located in the executive suite, which worked out well for Beck. Next to her office was that of Frederick Rubelman III, vice president of operations, who opened his door and asked, "Is everyone okay?" Rubelman was one of the executives who had rejected Beck's promotion to associate accountant. Rubelman confronted Beck head-on and was shot and killed. By this time, many of the 100 employees had escaped to the gravel parking lot. Beck sprinted after them, hunting down his last and biggest target, lottery president Otho Brown. It was the 54-year-old Brown who had final say on signing off on the rejection for Beck's promotion. Now hunted and pursued by his disgruntled worker, Brown was leading the employees toward a nearby forest for safety. Beck staggered outside and sprinted after his co-workers, the left leg of his jeans soaked in his victim's blood. Some employees dove into ditches, others dispersed, sinking into the soft mud. Brown apparently detoured back to the gravel parking lot. Some employees claimed that he was a hero trying to save his employees by using himself as bait to draw Beck away from them and toward him. Brown was caught alone in the gravel parking lot, trying to flee. Beck, an avid jogger and hiker, quickly overtook him. Brown backpedaled as Beck closed in. The lottery president held up his hands and cried, "No, Matt," then tripped and fell on his back. Beck stood over his boss with a Glock aimed at his head. The employees who had safely hidden in the forest marsh yelled out at Beck not to shoot. One fellow accountant yelled, Matthew, don't," while others screamed. Brown pleaded for his life and held his hands up defensively. Beck stood over him for a moment, breathing hard. He raised his pistol and fired twice. Brown went still as the employees in the woods screamed and cried. Beck stood for a moment, walked around Brown's limp body, then shot the corpse again, causing it to jerk. Just then, a white police car came tearing into the parking lot. Beck put the pistol up to his head and shot himself through the temple. Somehow, the gun went off twice. His body collapsed on the ground. Was Matthew Beck crazy? As one supervisor in the meeting room who survived described his choice of victims, they were the people who had the power in the lottery. They were the ones who turned down his promotion. Close quote. His parents released a statement to the press noting, "His murderous act was monstrous, but he was not a monster, as his friends and family can attest." And I'm reading an excerpt from Going Postal, Rage, Murder, and Rebellion from Reagan's Workplaces to Clinton's Columbine and Beyond by Mark Ames. This is on Welcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, Free Radio Asheville, WZKW Kingsville, or WRFN Nashville. Continuing with another excerpt, Anorexic Andy. There's a lot of hate around here that, a quote from Gentry Robler, Santana High sophomore.